Thank you very much. So I'm starting at 1:10. So is it okay if I stand on this corner? It's a little bit close to the screen there. That's all right. All right. So it's a great pleasure to be here, and I'm very honored to be invited to give this talk here. And as a matter of fact, I have been in this room probably like 9-10 years ago when I was a PhD student I came to visit for a summer school for quantum foundations, and I was sitting somewhere over there, I think. But yeah. Okay, so today I'm going to tell you a little bit about atomic spin squeezing experiments, and I'm going to try to focus mostly on concepts initially, and then I'm going to breeze through some of the experiments. So I have made, I have put more quantum states than I would normally put in these slides because I have a theory audience, so I reduced the number of experiment slides that I have. So let's start. Okay, you've been looking at an animation here. It's an animation of how a squeezed atomic clock looks like on a Bloch sphere, but we'll come back to this. So before we talk about squeezing and atomic clocks and things like that, I want to step back for a second and tell you a little bit more broadly where this kind of research fits in. So we essentially do quantum sensing. And if you ask what a quantum sensor is, the general answer is any physical object whose quantum mechanical degrees or properties are relevant in an experiment to measure some external perturbance is a quantum sensor. That's a relatively broad description. There are lots of different efforts in the field. Some popular examples are NV centers, for instance, in diamonds to sense nanoscale magnetic fields, micromechanical oscillators that are cooled to their ground states to force sensing, squeezed or other non-classical light to do interferometry. What I'm going to mostly focus on is quantum sensors based on atoms. In this talk, and these kind of sensors can measure external fields, forces, and they can be used for timekeeping. Here are a few of my current favorite atomic sensors. So these days, atomic clocks have become so sensitive that if you raise one of the atomic clocks above the other one by 10 centimeters, you can tell the gravitational redshift by the change in the ticking time. And the other favorite experiment of mine is searching for the electric dipole moment in molecules, where if you sense any kind of an energy shift between otherwise two aligned energy levels, you can actually, in principle, tell there is an electric dipole moment for the electron, and this is actually one of the experiments that constrains supersymmetry the best so far. And these are all tabletop experiments, as I'll show you some pictures later on. And another class of sensors that we also work with in our group, I'm coming from Stanford, by the way. I work with Mark Kasevich, the group that I'm in, is mostly interested in atom interferometers. And some of the ideas there is test Einstein's equivalence principle. You can detect gravitational waves potentially in the future. And there are some other experiments in other groups searching for dark energy. And there are some other practical applications such as inertial navigation and gravimetry. So in common to all of these kind of sensors is that they all reduce to a two-level quantum system, and they can all be improved in the same way by introducing quantum entanglement between these two-level systems. You can improve all of these sensors, and when I say quantum sensing, I typically talk, this is the, in strict sense, when I say quantum sensing, I mean use of quantum entanglement to do precision sensing. Okay. So then the question boils down to how can we control and exploit quantum correlations in large collections of atoms, ensembles of atoms. And in particular, we try to study and engineer entanglement in these systems so that we can do better precision sensors to test, for example, physical phenomena, fundamental ideas, fundamental physics tests. And the specific goal is, again, to improve the already best performing atom interferometers and sensors. It's not just the idea is not to do a proof of principle demonstration, but actually use these kind of techniques, quantum entanglement techniques, to improve the best existing sensors. Okay, so the talk will be of three parts. In the first part, I'll try to explain to you the concepts behind, for example, spin squeezing, entanglement, so that we're on the same page. And then in the second part, I'll briefly introduce the physical experimental setup that we use to implement these kind of ideas. And then I'll breeze through the experiments that some of the recent experiments that we have done. All right, so let's start with an example. A sensing example. Let me mention, I'm going to do everything in this first part twice, once with equations, once with pictures. So let's start with equations first. So let's say we want to measure a small energy shift between two levels of an atom. So let's call these two levels a spin half system. And the typical thing you do is you first prepare your spin in the down state. Then you put it in a quantum superposition of 50-50 up and down by making your rotation. And then some external perturbance acts on your system and shifts the energies of these two systems. And they acquire the two levels acquire energy shifts of opposite sign. And then to read out this phase shift, what you do is you make another rotation around an appropriate axis. And you map the phase information into population difference between the two states. So here, this is an approximation, I'm assuming. The phase is a small phase. So at the end, you end up with a population that is modulated, the population of the up and down states that's modulated with the original phase shift. And you see what's the probability of having the atom up, what's the probability of having it down, and you infer the phase shift. This is pretty basic stuff that is employed on a daily basis. But you don't do this with a single atom. In order to actually measure a small phase shift, you put together a large number of atoms, you prepare them all in an identical state of a 50-50 superposition, and you do the same actions you did previously, and then you end up with all atoms reflecting the same population difference. So if you go ahead and plot the number of atoms in the up state here, I've done this as an example for 100 atoms with a phase shift of 0.2 radians. Now you can, from the two distributions, when there's a phase shift and when there's no phase shift, you can tell the difference that there has been a phase shift, actually, if you have sufficiently large number of atoms. This is a binomial distribution, essentially. And the width of these distributions is known as either the projection noise or the atomic shot noise, and it goes as the square root of the number of atoms that you're using. So all good. In the next slide, I want to tell you a little bit about how we can theoretically think about the quantum states that underlie all of these experiments. So I want to introduce you the idea of Dicke states, which will come in handy in a couple of slides. So in the previous slide, I told you we have n identical two-level systems, and then we prepare these atoms, systems in an identical state. Then what happens is we constrain ourselves to n states in the Hilbert space that are in the symmetric subspace of this large Hilbert space of two to the n possible states. So a general state that is a separable state where all atoms are in the same state is given like this. So the theta represents the population differences, essentially, and phi represents the phase shift between the two states. This is called the coherent spin state. If you try to really figure out what the state is all about, you just expand the state and you write out all possible combinations once you multiply these states out. There are a very large number of states, possible states that you write out here. So that's not very useful. Instead, we use to explain these states the Dicke basis, known as, which is these J and M indices that characterizes a Dicke state, which is essentially the M is the projection of the spin on the Z collective spin on the z direction, and j is the total angular momentum of the system, of the collection of spins. And there's a coefficient in front of this, which is just simply the binomial distribution. So I'm telling you what I have plotted in the previous slide more in terms of quantum states. So what is a decay state? Here's an example. So JZ operator is the collective angular momentum operator of all the atoms. And if I have, let's say, I'm giving you an example with four particles here. If I have four particles, J is the total number of atoms divided by two, so J is two. These are all possible decay states, as you see there, combinations of states. For example, the 2-0 state is the total angular momentum 2. Z projection 0 is a combination of all these possible six states where you have equal number of up and down states. So these are automatically entangled states, but the initial states were not entangled, because if you prepare a particular state which was separable, although components are entangled, it looked like they're entangled, the total is not necessarily entangled, yes?
Why are we focusing on the symmetric subspace? Sorry.
By construction, we want to remain in the subspace, because typically the way you do these experiments is you prepare a large number of particles in the same state. When they're all in the same state, when you expand it out, you're only in the symmetric subspace. And that's the largest. If you have inhomogeneities in your system, you lose signal. You don't want to do that. You want to stay in the symmetric subspace for typical experimental configurations.
Okay.
All right, let's go back to some pictures now. We don't typically think of our sensors in terms of these quantum states. We know what they are, but we typically draw these pictures. So we have n two-level atoms, and we say these are spin-half systems. And in the experiments that I'm going to show you, these are going to be rubidium 87 atoms, the hyperfine transition, two hyperfine states of rubidium 87 atoms. There's a convenient representation on the Bloch sphere. So the JZ axis corresponds to the population difference between the two states in your ensemble. And where you are on the equator corresponds to the phase difference between the two states. And to be technically correct, this is a Wigner function on a sphere. And you have the state represented on the surface of the sphere, which has an uncertainty of, it's a round state, and it has an uncertainty of square root of n over 2 along any direction. So you get a round state when you have uncorrelated particles. So this automatically takes care of the phase noise is square root of n over 2, and population noise is square root of n over 2. Okay, so that's not the whole story. We don't really want uncorrelated particles. We want correlated particles. And when you go to correlation, when you have correlations, you can get states like this on the Bloch sphere, where you have the uncertainty squeezed in one direction at the expense of having it expanded in the other direction to preserve the uncertainty principle. And this necessarily implies entanglement. And in terms of the states that I was showing you in the previous page, you can write a squeeze state as a superposition of these decay states with coefficients such that the uncertainty in that coefficient, the standard deviation of the population difference, for example, is lower than this uncorrelated case of square root of n over 2. So let me point out, once you have a squeeze state, then you might imagine that if our goal is to measure small rotations on the sphere, you can do it a lot better with a squeeze state than an unsqueezed state. So I'll show you an example now. And this is a typical atom sensor that you run. It's called a Ramsey sequence. This is going to be a replica of the very first page when I showed you how you do a sensing measurement, but in terms of pictures now. You prepare all the atoms in the down state. You apply a rotation on the Bloch sphere, a pi over 2 rotation to come on the equator, where you have a 50-50 superposition of all the particles. Then an external unknown perturbation puts a phase shift on your system. And then you map that phase shift onto population difference by making another rotation. And using this for uncorrelated particles, you can resolve that phase shift at the standard quantum limit, which goes as 1 over the square root of the number of atoms. You use squeeze states, everything is plug and play remains the same. You just start with squeeze states and do the same protocol that you did previously. You start with number squeeze states. That's how we do in our experiment. And then typically you don't really want to measure number. You want to measure phase, as we illustrated here. So you rotate that into phase sensitive orientation. And then the unknown phase acts. You convert that into population difference and you read it out, the population differences. So using this kind of a scheme, in principle, you can reach the Heisenberg limit, which goes as the phase resolution is goes as 1 over the number of particles. Okay. So, yes.
Is that resolution, is reaching that limit the point at which you basically squeezed entirely around the sphere?
Yes, if the moment you reach that is essentially you have squeezed all the way almost here and then you don't gain anymore.
It doesn't.
So a decay state, by the way, is a state that's completely wrapped around. It's a line on this representation. So you squeeze it all the way down to a decay state. It's a complete line. And those states are not necessarily easily sensitive to any rotations because you can't tell which way it rotated, for example.
Experimentally, how do you implement these rotations in this?
Yeah, so these are microwave transitions in an atom. I'll come back to it in a second, but essentially you apply microwave pulses to atoms which rotate states or swap populations and things like that. Okay, so I'm going to tell you in a few slides we have this much of squeezing, so I just want to give you how we code these numbers. And people typically code squeezing in dBs, and squeezing also is, you don't quote the amount of reduction in noise. Instead, you quote the reduction in variance because variance turns out to be the relevant number. For example, if you have 20 dB squeezing, that means your variance was reduced by a factor of 100, and that means you need 100 times less atoms to do the same experiment, or you can do the same experiment 100 times faster to reach the same precision level. Squeezing has been done with many other physical systems before, light, microwaves, mechanical oscillators. But the results I'm going to tell you shows that atoms are the best so far, that they have the largest amount of squeezing that have been demonstrated so far.
This is compared to the standard expectation, the square root of n expectation.
Correct. Mm-hmm. For example, before our experiments, the strongest reduction compared to the standard limit was 12.7 dB for photons in this case. Okay, so let me tell you what these actually correspond to in the lab, all of these states and methods I was telling you about. So we have these rubidium atoms, and they have these two magnetically insensitive hyperfine ground states separated by 6.8 gigahertz. You can shine microwaves onto them to make transitions from this down state to up state at 6.8 gigahertz. And similarly, by sending these microwaves, you can do all of these rotations on the Bloch sphere that I was telling you about earlier. And we have this excited state here, which is optically connected to the ground states. We use that state to prepare the squeeze state. We use this light to prepare the squeeze state. So let me tell you how we do this. So there are two ways of doing squeezing. One is you can either imagine atoms are interacting with each other and getting entangled and going into a squeeze state. That's one way. The other way is purely a quantum non-demolition measurement-based method. So you measure the collective state of the atoms, and then it collapses into a reduced uncertainty state. So the very act of measurement prepares these entangled states. So I'll tell you how that happens now. So imagine we have an ensemble of atoms sitting here, and this light, atom light detuning, the frequency of the light is chosen such that if the atoms are in the up state, they cause one sign of a phase shift on the light. If the atoms are in the down state, they cause the opposite sign of a phase shift on the light. So if you have an ensemble of atoms and the light goes through, the phase shift on the light represents the population difference between these two atoms, these two states in the ensemble. And the important thing is that you have no idea which atom is contributing to this phase shift. So that creates this indistinguishability in the state. And when you make a phase measurement on the light interferometrically, that projects the atomic ensemble onto an entangled state, which has less uncertainty. We do it in a little bit different fashion. We have a highly reflective optical cavity. We put all of the atoms into the cavity, and we trap these atoms with this 1560 nanometer light. And that light forms trapping potentials for the atoms. The atoms are the dark wave packets here. And from the other side, we send in our probe light, which is this light that I was telling you earlier, to measure the population difference between the two states. And one important thing here is note the frequency doubled relation here. Wherever we have the atoms trapped, the probe light has the standing wave of the probe light has a maximum. So that means all atoms are identically, uniformly interacting with our probe. So there's no distinguishability or anything like that. So once we put atoms in the cavity, the problem turns into a measuring cavity resonance frequency measurement, because the atoms cause a phase shift that effectively changes the resonance frequency of the cavity. So essentially, if you can measure the resonance frequency of the cavity very precisely, you can make a projection of these states onto a squeezed entangled quantum state. So that's the basic principle behind it. And now in equations.
In the experimental setups, how many, let's say, atoms are in each one of these lattice tracks?
Yeah, great. We have about the cavity is 10 centimeters, so it's like this big of a cavity. The atoms occupy about a millimeter range at the center, or a little less than a millimeter. More correctly, it's about 1,000 lattice sites. We have about up to 1 million atoms, so it's about 1,000 atoms per lattice pancake that are hanging out in this. So they're along the axis, they're tightly trapped in this standing wave potential. And in the radial direction, they're not very tightly trapped, so they're free to hang around, all of those 1,000 atoms in these pancakes. They're located there. Okay. Yes, in equations, what I have said in the previous slide with pictures is the following. We have an interaction Hamiltonian that is of the following sort. So we have Jz, the population difference operator of the atoms, is coupled to the energy of the cavity. A dagger A is essentially the photon number inside of the cavity, which is proportional to the energy. And this Hamiltonian generates proportional to the population difference, generates phase shifts on the light. And Dicke states here come into picture again. So if you start with all the atoms in uncorrelated state of the atoms and the field, so you have all of your atoms prepared in this coherent spin states with the microwave pulses that I was telling you earlier, and then you're going to send in a coherent state of light. Initially, they're uncorrelated. After the light goes into the cavity, comes back out, the state you get is a phase shift on your coherent state proportional to the population difference. So again, in pictures, you have a coherent state initially that you have sent into your cavity, and depending on what the population difference was, you have an entangled state of the light and the atoms, such that the phase shift is proportional to the population difference m here. So, and then you do an interferometric measurement on one of the quadratures of your light, in particular the p quadrature here. The moment you measure that, you know what your spin states are better than you did initially, and it's projected into an entangled squeeze state. How well can we measure resolve?
Yeah.
So our current resolution is about 15 spin flips. M equals 15 is the current resolution, limited by.
How big is the system?
It's about 500,000 atoms.
Okay.
So J is 500,000, let's say, or
so
quarter
from. The smearing of the blob is 15 mm.
The smearing of the blob is, so square root of n over 2 is 350. So we have an initial uncertainty of 350. That's the shot noise, that's the.
Yeah, and then you reduce
We measure it, we reduce it to 15-ish. That's the current. The limitation comes from our technical setup can measure all the way down to three. But as you'll see in a couple of slides, there are other fundamental limitations which prevent us from going below 15.
And the 3 is coming from where?
Three is just how well the lasers are stabilized to the cavity resonance. It's completely a laser frequency stability issue. So, yes, I'll show you the limitation in the next couple of slides.
If you go back 2 slides, like both, and one more. Yeah. So both the atoms and like the atoms sitting in these traps, how well localized are they at the center of these traps so that you can really be confident that each one of them is interacting, you know, exactly the same with the probeam?
So these are, I have answers for all of those questions. I haven't told you, they're cold atoms. They're about 25, they are laser cooled. They're about 25 microkelvins. And at that, given the lattice depth and the temperature, they are localized within 25 to 50 nanometers at the center of these traps. And the trapping wavelength is 1560. So half the wave, so 780 is the trap period. So they're localized to 1/10 of the period of the lattice. And the homogeneity turns out to be about 85%, though, due to finite temperature issues.
About 85%?
Yeah.
Okay. And so, is that one of these things that's contributing to this 15?
Right now, no.
Okay.
So those that's completely out of the picture currently. We don't need to improve on that currently. So that uniformity will become important in the very last slide I'll show you. Okay, so this is what it looks like in the lab. It's really a tabletop experiment. We have some lasers in the background, some cameras, other things, and voltmeter. So, but the heart of the experiment happens in this corner of the table. When we zoom in, you find a cage where you have a glass chamber inside. If you zoom in a little bit more and strip it off of the coils that's generating the magnetic fields to trap these atoms, it looks like this. This is the cavity. It's a 10 centimeter long cavity. Here's an atom source that you heat it up. Rubidium atoms start coming off of it. Here's a region for collimation. There's a pinhole here. We collimate the atoms with lasers and magnetic fields here, and goes right into the center of the cavity where it's loaded into a so-called magneto-optical trap, where they're trapped right inside at the center of the cavity. And once they're there, we turn on this lattice that I was showing you in the earlier slides that comes in from one of the sides of the cavity. And the atoms are transferred into the lattice, and we further cool them in the lattice to 25 microkelvins. And the experiments that I'm going to tell you about start from there on. Okay, so let me breeze through these experiments and give you a sense of.
I just asked, what is the time scale for like how long you can keep these guys trapped in there before?
1 second currently.
Okay.
It's limited by the background pressure of the vacuum, so. Background atoms come and collide with them and knock them out of the cavity. So it's roughly a second right now, but hundreds of seconds are typical in ultra-cold atom experiments. So, yeah, literally hundreds to 1,000 seconds I've seen. Okay, so we want to demonstrate that we have squeezing. So we need to do a few things to demonstrate this. First, we need to show that we understand the projection noise or the atomic shot noise level. This we need to have a good calibration of what square root of n over 2 is. So fortunately, we have a good understanding of this in our system. So to verify this, or to actually show that we can go down to shot noise, we first apply this microwave pi over 2 rotation to bring the state from the bottom to the equator. we have a 50-50 state, and we should have an uncertainty of square root of n over 2. And then, to see this, we actually send our probe to the cavity and make a histogram of how many times we get a particular population difference value. And then we plot that histogram, and it looks like a Gaussian distribution, as expected. This experiment is done with, for example, 200,000 atoms, and I think over 1,000 measurements were done to make these histograms. And as a function of atom numbers you use, you see that quantum noise grows as, indeed, square root of n over 2, as expected. And we have some technical background coming from the microwave rotations, which is not very important right now. So, one, we can understand the shot noise level so that we can say that we are actually squeezed. So, next, we want to now show the spin noise reduction. So, the idea here is, okay, we prepare this coherent spin state, and then we make a first measurement that generates the squeezed state, collapses it into a particular squeezed state. And then in order to actually show that we have squeezing, we need to make one more measurement of the same type to see that it's the same state. So when you, if you remember from the previous slide, if you make measurements on this state, it becomes a little bit noisy. It's uncertain every time you measure. But once you make the same one measurement and measure it again to see if it's the same value, you can, by looking at how tightly the correlations are between the first and the second measurement, you can show that this state is actually squeezed. And here's a typical measurement of that, and this comes back to the issue of where that number 15 comes from. So on the x-axis is the measurement strength. This is about how many photons you're sending into the cavity to measure the resonance frequency of the cavity. And on the y-axis is the noise between the difference, noise in the difference between the two measurements. So let's pick an atom number here. Let's say the green curve, 100,000 atoms, and let's track it. So the more light we send in, we resolve the population difference better and better, and the state is getting squeezed more and more. And then at some point, it turns around and goes back. The more light you send in, you don't do a better measurement anymore, because what I haven't talked about is the spontaneous emission noise that comes from the atoms. So although we have only a dispersive interaction with the atoms, such that I'm talking about phase shifts that are induced onto the light by the atoms, we inevitably have some spontaneous emission. It turns out no matter what you do, you're limited with this spontaneous emission. So following the spontaneous emission, you can get spin flips. So an up atom initially can accidentally scatter into a down atom. So you're trying to measure the population difference, but in the meanwhile, you're introducing a random walk on the population difference. So that's why it turns around about 15-ish. So we can't do better than that currently.
What does it mean, zero?
Sorry?
What does it mean?
Zero atoms? Is that what? Zero atoms is a calibration measurement where we don't put in any atoms and see how well we can fictitiously resolve Jz.
What does it mean? Yeah, this is what I don't understand.
Oh, okay.
It's
so
Jz measurement.
So there's a certain, each atom shifts the cavity resonance by 5 hertz.
Oh, okay.
And then we don't put atoms, and we see how well of a frequency resolution we can get. And then we convert that to an atom number to see that we're not limited by anything else. It's the atoms that are causing the noise. Okay, so that's the second requirement to show you have squeezing, that you have actually reduced the noise. You might think that we're done, but there's one more, which you need to show that you have preserved the coherence in your system. Because if you have completely decohered your system, or said other ways, you're no longer in the symmetric subspace, the state can shrink to the center of the Bloch sphere if you have no coherence, and that state is useless for metrology. You can try to do any kind of rotations on the Bloch sphere, and the state will not go anywhere. So we do this by applying more microwave. We generate the squeeze state. We rotate the state on the sphere by applying microwave pulses again, And we show that states are pretty much completely coherent, showing a 96.2% fringe contrast as we rotate the state around the sphere. And all in all, we essentially are being able to generate 20 dB of squeezing. But then the question is, how much of this 20 dB can we actually use in an actual metrology experiment? So we have a quick little demonstration here for that. We generate these squeeze states. We make it. We choose to whether or not make a small rotation and see if we can tell that actually we have made the rotation or not. And this is a distribution you would have obtained had you not squeezed. So this is a coherent spin state. And these are the distributions you obtain had when you actually squeeze. So one of these states distributions correspond to a unrotated state, and the other one corresponds to the rotated state. So let me emphasize the importance of this. So we're being able to use 18.5 dB of the initial squeezing to do a complete metrology experiment. The importance of this is that this is the first time that a quantum-enhanced atomic sensor has shown beyond what has been done classically. So here's why I say that. We use about 600,000 atoms, and we reach this 140 microradians phase rotation resolution. To reach the same resolution without entangled atoms, you need 70 times more atoms. And typically, these experiments do not run with more than a couple to a few million atoms. That's not practically possible because interactions between the atoms, generically speaking, can cause systematic errors in these sensors, so you cannot bump up the atom numbers too much. So spin squeezing and entanglement is genuinely helping in this case.
So sorry, the claim is if you try to go, if you try to measure anything smaller than 140 microradians, these two peaks get so close together that they're unresolvable? Like, that's what you mean when you say that only 18.5 dB of this is usable?
We had 20 dB, but we had been able to use only 18.5 of it because of some extra noise that comes in during these manipulations. That's what I mean.
In other words, those two peaks are too close. Like, I can't resolve those two peaks.
Yes, so if you go smaller than 100, if you were to make a rotation that's smaller than 140 microradians here, these peaks get too close to each other, so you cannot resolve it.
Okay.
And again, the message was that if they were uncorrelated, this was the distribution, and good luck telling that small of a shift in that distribution with this kind of a width. Okay. We also did a atomic clock measurement. This is more like a proof of principle, but illustrates the idea of these phase measurements. In the previous slide, we did a population difference measurement. Here, we're going to do a phase shift measurement. So we first prepare these squeezed population difference states. With a microwave pulse, we rotate them into the phase-sensitive state, and then we essentially wait for a little bit of time, and then we rotate the state back into the population-sensitive state, where the phase noise here maps onto the population noise, and compare our microwave source with the atoms themselves to see how good of a...
So this is a pi over 2 pulse that does that, right? The second phase.
This from here to here is a pi over 2 pulse around this axis.
Okay.
So, and then we compare with our microwaves, essentially. We're comparing the phase of our microwaves to the phase of our atoms. That's the essence of an atomic clock. And here we show, using this with squeeze state, we can actually improve the performance of a clock here by 10 dB, which is limited by our microwave source in this case. So this is a typical curve that you will see in atomic clock talks. It's called an Allen deviation curve. It's the fractional frequency stability of the clock as a function of averaging time, how many times you do this experiment over time. So each of our experiments is 1 second. And we average over time to resolve the frequency better and better. With an unentangled clock, this is how you average down. With an entangled clock, you average down the same way, but you start from a lower noise to begin with, so an improvement. And in this experiment, we showed that we can average to the same precision 11 times faster.
Is that
limited by the power of your microwave source?
That's limited by the phase noise of our microwave source currently. Not currently, we have a new microwave source now and we're trying to go beyond that. If the microwave source itself is very noisy, we have no way of saying, we might still have 20 dB squeezing there, but there's no way of saying that we actually had that squeezing, because it just, what we're comparing is the phase of the atoms to the phase of the microwaves. If one of them is super noisy, there's no way to say if this was squeezed anymore. Okay, so in summary, let me tell you how well we're doing. We're doing very well. This is coming from a recent review article in 2016, which compiles together a large number of quantum sensing experiments with trapped ions, Bose-Einstein condensates, cold thermal atoms. In this order, you get more and more atoms. So in the cold thermal atoms, that's where we belong, you get the largest number of atoms, of up to a million. And there are lots of different symbols, for example, showing what's the amount of squeezing you get, how much of it you can actually use for metrology, and how much of it you can use for a clock, for example, a phase measurement. So this is our best level of inferred squeezing in our metrology demonstration and our clock demonstration. It's good in all levels. It's kind of state of the art right now. Okay, so...
So you're able to get this incredible decibel gain. Fractionally, you're much further away from the Heisenberg limit for the number of particles you're at.
Yes.
But I should expect that because you guys have pushed to a much, much, much larger particle number. And so the difference of square root of n and n for
is very large. It's becoming larger. So you want to go to larger atom numbers for precision measurements because you want better phase resolution. With a few atoms, you don't have good phase resolution. You want as many atoms as possible, as much squeezing as possible for it to be practically applicable. So in the next few minutes, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and tell you about another experiment that we did, which addresses an issue that you can see here. So most of the experiments in this plot lie down here, like a gain of a factor of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We're up here, 100. Why are all of these experiments down there, but we're there? The answer turns out to be that technically making these measurements are pretty hard and time-consuming in terms of building a system that's sufficiently low noise. So we asked ourselves, well, can we do something about this? And we came up with the following idea that we call quantum phase magnification. And this is a recently growing line of thought. It's also known as interaction-based readout. More and more people are showing attention to these kind of experiments these days. And here's the idea. So if it's hard to make these measurements, if I'm not being able to make a good population difference measurement, let me do something else. Let's say I have these two initial states I want to distinguish between. It's a coherent state, either with a little bit of positive population difference or a negative one. And let's say I don't have the sufficient resolution to tell the difference between these two. Can I generate an interaction in this ensemble of atoms such that the quantum state somehow gets magnified on the Bloch sphere into this? And then I'll have a much easier time reading out these states without having a good detector. And for this part of the talk, you don't have to worry about Bloch spheres. Now you can just focus on this planar patch of the sphere, which is just a simple phase space. Again, Jz is the population difference, Jy is the phase, and we have a state either this or that we want to see which one we have, separated by a distance S.
Can I ask a very question? Why do you want to squeeze them be squeezed in the Z direction instead of having them like this?
Oh, yeah, let me clarify this. Okay. So our goal is to tell the difference between... So I'm illustrating this here with coherent spin states, which are round blobs. Essentially, what we want to do is we want to be able to tell the difference between two squeeze states, like this.
Okay.
And then if you do the same analogy, we want to stretch them like this, and then it goes into that picture again. Okay. So the goal is to be able to tell this very closely separated squeeze states, tell them apart. And then the method is to somehow do a stretching action on the block sphere to convert these into these kind of distribution. So this goes into that, this goes into that.
And why is the thing on the right better?
Because, so this is the population difference, Jz, and your detector is resolution, let's say, is this much, and it's not being able to tell.
Oh.
Now, with this kind of a resolution, they're easily tellable. So you map this state onto that, this state onto that. With a bad detector, you can still tell them apart, whereas you couldn't tell them in this case apart.
Somehow the mapping is such that the top state only gets squeezed upwards and the other gets, you know, like, you're not just, these blobs don't overlap.
Right.
Correct. So initially they don't overlap, finally they don't overlap. It's a unitary transformation. Two states that initially don't overlap, if you do it right, they will have still the same overlap, but they're mapped into different places in phase space.
Give an example of what gives you that initial separation in the JZ direction between the two blobs. Like what sort of...
For example, the energy measurement that I was telling you, or the clock measurement. So, like this, whether I prepare this squeeze state and I chose whether or not to rotate. So, can I tell the difference between this state and that state? So a microwave rotation would separate them like that. A very small microwave pulse, which is doing a rotation on the block sphere. Or similarly, the phase shift coming from an external perturbance. So if you get again, you're on the block sphere here. You're initially, okay, this is the sphere, Jz. Does this look like a sphere from there? Okay, let me draw a head-on sphere. This is the head-on sphere. I have an initial squeeze state like this, and if there is an external thing, disturbance acting on this to shift the phase this way, now the phase is shifted. So I have now either this state or that state that I want to say whether there was a phase shift or not. So I make a rotation on the block sphere on this axis to rotate this into this and that state. So that's how the initial states end up with. Either I have a phase shift or I don't have a phase shift. Is that clear? Okay. Okay, so I'll tell you how we do this. Let's see how much time I have. So I told you we have a trick with the cavity. We were using the cavity to make a measurement on the atoms. So that was number one. Now we have a second trick that we can actually use the cavity to generate effective interactions between the atoms, and here's the idea. So an optical resonator, any kind of resonator, has a resonance frequency. And I told you that depending on the population difference, the resonance frequency of this resonator cavity shifts. So here is the resonance transmission of the cavity for a population difference of minus 200, and here is for plus 200. So the cavity resonance frequencies are shifted from each other for those two cases. So now if we go ahead and send some light at an off-resonant frequency initially, this means that how far off resonant this light is going to be different, and a different amount of light is going to build up inside of the cavity depending on the population difference of these atoms. So now that amount of light that built up in the cavity is going to act back onto the atoms to cause phase shift on the atoms. That's called an AC Stark shift, and that closes the complete loop where you get a atomic phase shift proportional to the population difference. So atoms shift the cavity resonance, intercavity power changes, and the AC star shift on the atoms change so that you get an atomic phase shift that's proportional to the collective population. So that's the feedback and doing the generating the effective interactions. And it's this Hamiltonian, which is the population difference squared, Jz squared.
Why is it quadratic in the populations?
Why is it quadratic in the population?
Is it not quadratic? You say the atomic phase shift is proportional to linear.
It is?
The interaction is quadratic, yes, but why is the atomic phase shift proportional to Jz, not quadratic in Jz?
So Jz is the generator of rotations on the Bloch sphere.
Yeah.
If you had an Hamiltonian, chi Jz, you will have a phase shift on each atom that's proportional to chi. Agreed?
Yes, I agree. Okay.
So now we have a Jz squared Hamiltonian, which is equal to Jz times Jz times chi. So this is a heuristic way of thinking about it. This is a generator, and the amount is proportional to Jz itself. So you get a rotation that generates the rotation that's proportional to Jz itself.
I see.
And you might not be seeing it over there, but all right. Okay, and here is how it works. Here is what it does. So we start with these two initial states that we want to distinguish between. Again, I'm showing you the coherent state version right now, but we're actually interested in separating, distinguishing squeeze states. So you apply this Jz squared interaction, which is a shearing interaction. It's this Jz dependent phase shift. Depending on the Jz value, it stretches each point on the sphere to on the surface to a new point. So Jz is negative, this point goes here. Jz is zero, this point stays here. Jz is positive, this point goes there. So you get this shearing effect where this picture maps into this picture. And if you think about it for a second, this is very much analogous to the free expansion of a gas. If you think Jy is the position of an atom and Jz is the momentum of an atom, there's one-to-one correspondence between this phase space picture that I'm providing here and the phase space picture of just an expanding gas. Then you make a final rotation around this axis to bring this to the orientation we originally intended to. And to demonstrate the idea in this experiment, what we have done is after generating this shearing with the cavity, we no longer use the cavity to make measurements. Instead, we have released our atoms and pushed them from the cavity and pushed them state selectively with a laser. And then we just imaged our atoms to count how many atoms were in the one state and how many atoms were in the same in the other state. And in that experiment, our resolution for that kind of a measurement was terrible. In fact, 15 dB above the standard shot noise for that case. But as you'll see, we're being able to, with this method, with such a bad detection scheme, we're being able to recover squeeze states. So let me show you the very first data that was. So here's what we do to demonstrate this. We initially generate these two possible states characterize them with the cavity. So one state corresponds to one of the blobs in the previous picture. The other corresponds to the other blob. We use the cavity to characterize that we have prepared the states we wanted to prepare, and then we use the magnification scheme and then just count the atoms with fluorescence imaging and plot the same distribution. They look identical, but the only difference is that if you look at the x-axis is 45 times larger than in this case, so we're being able to tell this a lot more easily. And the main point that we also did this with squeeze states, we prepared these 8 dB squeeze states and then did this magnification scheme and measured with this terrible atom counting scheme, which had a noise floor of 15 dB above shot noise, and we fully recovered the 8 dB squeeze initial states from the system. So this is an example of what is these days called interaction-based readout. Okay, so let me wrap up. In this last slide, I'll tell you, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, what we've been up to recently. So recently we were working on freeing these atoms from the optical lattice. Why do we want to do this? Because we want to do atom interferometry. While atoms are free-falling, we want to split their wave packets in free space and combine them to sense accelerations and things like that, for example. To be able to do this, we cannot keep the atoms in the lattice. So the question is, are we going to be able to preserve the squeezing once we release these atoms from the cavity? And one comment is, why not? It turns out that if you're generating these states non-uniformly, meaning that if the atoms are not identically coupled to your probe, where you're measuring an observable that's not a uniform combination of your individual spins, there's no way to recover the squeezing after you release the atoms from their individual locations. Because to recover this squeezing in this observable, you need to access the exact combination of the atomic couplings once you release them. But there's no way to get back to this. So by doing this uniform coupling, we expect that we can fully recover the squeezing once the atomic locations are scrambled. So recently what we have shown is we can actually release these atoms from the cavity, let them free fall for a millisecond or two, and then we have recaptured them back into the cavity. They went to completely different places. And we have we showed that we can actually preserve 12 dB of squeezing in that case. And the limitation there also comes from the atom loss, which squeeze states are very sensitive to. If you lose atoms, you lose squeezing. And residual inhomogeneities in your system. And that meniscal resin preparation. What we have done also is...
Can I ask, when you say release and then recapture, what all is being released? Is it just the trapping beam, or is it all the magnetic field confinement that's used to...
Magnetic field confinement is off after trapping them in the lattice to begin with.
Okay.
Just the lattice is the thing that's holding them. And essentially, we turn off the lattice.
Wait a millisecond.
Atoms fall a little bit, but that's not too long of a time for them to go anywhere. And then you turn it back on, and it sucks everything back in.
Is this enough time? And I guess, no, they're probably too cold. So they probably land, like, do they jump multiple lattice sites in either direction?
Oh, yeah.
This time? Okay.
Oh, too many lattice sites.
Okay.
They're expanding also. They go out of the, they can even, in 1 millisecond, they jump like tens of lattice sites easily. So 1 millisecond is not very long, though. 1 millisecond is not a time you would do an atom interferometer for. You would want to go for like hundreds of milliseconds. So this was just a proof of principle there that we can show that this uniform coupling actually works, and we can do this release, and we can access squeezing again. What we are doing right now is making the second measurement to recover squeezing with fluorescence imaging. So in that case, we just release the atoms from the lattice, and the atoms fall forever in principle. And then you image them with a camera. But in this case, it has to be a good detection efficiency camera. And we have been working on this for a while, and now we actually have some preliminary results showing that can release the atoms and make them fall for a while and image them with a camera and recover 5 dB of squeezing. So it's an important step towards doing these atom interferometer experiments. Let me wrap up here by saying everything I have told you so far about is about how sensitive of a measurement we can make, how much we can improve the precision of these sensors. But one other question one can ask is, what's going on with the quantum state of these atoms? Like, I said, yes, they're entangled, but I haven't quantified how entangled they are. So we have done two experiments towards these kind of questions. One is the entanglement depth experiment, and one is the Bell correlations. In the entanglement depth experiment, it's a long story, but we have, following this some theory paper, we have shown that we can indeed prove that we have at least 1,600 particles entangled there, meaning that if you have a million atoms, groups of 1,600 at least must be in entangled states where you cannot separate them out from the ensemble, the quantum state. And we have also shown this, again following this other theory paper, we have also shown that We can violate Bell inequalities with this kind of a system. So what's new here is that typically you do Bell experiments with two spins, two particles, you send them far away from each other, and you need to access to the individual degrees of freedom of these particles to show that there are non-local correlations or Bell violations. The advancement here is that this theory shows that you can actually, without having access to individual particles, just making collective observations on this ensemble, you can actually still violate Bell's. They're, in a not strict sense, but they're still called Bell violations. So that's another aspect of it. And in the near future, we're going to try to do atom interferometry with these squeeze states that so far has not been done. And that's it for now.
As you probably know better than I do, there are these nice manufactured chip scale atomic clocks.
Yeah.
There are rubidium clocks that you can do atomic precision time measurements with. I was curious, they're at a really interesting level where the sensitivity, the Allen variance is not quite good enough for you to be able to measure time dilation and going up on a mountain. Mm-hmm. And so I was curious whether these squeezing techniques could be miniaturized and what the obstacles to doing that would
be. Yes, definitely.
They could be incorporated.
Yes, they could definitely be incorporated. That the as I said at the beginning, it's a very plug and play method. It's system independent. And in principle, there is no problem with miniaturization. There are different ways of generating squeezing, but if you were going about doing this by using optical cavities as we're doing here, yes, they can be miniaturized and incorporated into those kind of systems in principle. Yeah, it's possible. And the best advantages might even be in those kind of systems where you're not doing the world's best job, but there's room for improvement.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So just for a non-expert, can you elaborate a little on the significance of these Bell violations? Because I have a vague memory of what it all means, but not really. But it sounds significant. Can you?
Yeah. So basically, as I have written here, we know quantum mechanics is inconsistent with the local realistic description of reality. So you have to either refute locality, interactions are not local, or realism, meaning that states do not exist before you measure, really, in that sense. So what we have shown here.
So that's the part that I remember, hidden variable, et cetera, that the original Bell experiment says no to all that. Okay.
Yeah. So what we're doing here is we are doing this kind of a violation, in a sense, with not just two particles, but these persist with up to a million particles. These kind of violations, these kind of counterintuitive correlations can still be shown even with a million atoms, you can call it a larger object. So mm-hmm. It's not necessarily limited to just observing two tiny quantum mechanical particles, but even if you're measuring collective observables of large groups of atoms, you can still show that there are correlations that violate this intuition of localism and realism.
So it strengthens the original conclusions in a sense.
Yes. So it does not, yes, it just strengthens it and carries it into a different domain.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.